because everything that kid has said, this is not the storm you want for student housing, where you have kids in confined bench areas and you have classes not open in a lot of places. And it showed it was very well. And once the world has started to normalize, you've seen some of the largest institutional investors in the world invest into student housing. Brookfield just signed a huge deal. Blackstone just signed a huge deal. You're seeing a ton of money flood into the space even more because they saw there's higher yields in the student housing space and traditional multifamily or even single family rental. And the asset class sticks up in the worst case scenarios.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Zach Feldman is the Vice President of Development at Aptitude Development. They are one of the nation's top student housing firms. He spearheads the company's new development efforts. They currently own over 4,000 beds with another $250 million of student housing under construction. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here, Sam.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. You know, there's three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you quickly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Yeah, I will give the abbreviated version, but happy to dig into anything you find interesting. So I grew up in Boston. I went to school down in North Carolina. And then, you know, I grew up in a quasi real estate family. So, you know, my family owned a few buildings throughout the Boston metro. And like my summer job, I was on a maintenance crew for one of our family friends that owned some buildings, just power washing buildings in the Boston summers. I rented some apartments as well throughout the summer. And then, you know, I kind of made internship my junior summer in college in the renewable energy space. I want to be a renewable energy trader. This is the coolest thing in the world. I've seen real estate. Say it's not for me. I think I want to have, you know, some exposure to it as I get older, but that's not the career path I want. Fast forward, I finally got on an energy trading desk. That was my dream job, and I absolutely hated it. It was not at all what I wanted to do. You know, and at the same time, I bought my first four family with an FHA loan when I was 22. And I was like, wow, I'm having way more fun and enjoyment looking at deals and understanding real estate and teaching myself the business on my nights and weekends. I called it, you know, my day job and my night job. And as I started to do that and get more comfortable with the business and understand how it worked and all the dynamics of that, I started to buy more and more on the side. And because I was just graduating college, I thought I understood student housing. Yeah, I lived in a, you know, single family and we had, you know, parties, and how hard can it be? And so what I did was I just took a list of every college town in the country. I took their median home price, and then I figured out what a one bed, a two bed, and a three bed rented. So I figured out my rent per bed. And then I picked out the highest yield where I thought my money could go the furthest, because I didn't have any money when I was just out of college, and figured out where I could start investing money at my age to do that. So that brought me to Buffalo, New York, where I bought a few other properties after that. We bought some stuff in Providence, Rhode Island. And I started raising money from friends and family, and I started getting, you know, hard money loans and fix and flip and refi out. And we built up a decent portfolio, but I still had day jobs. Fast forward to where I am today, I was doing this and, you know, at a very, you know, small clip, but was really enjoying it and thought, I want to be in real estate. I like the tangible part of the business. And, you know, as things started to ramp up, and this was when, you know, WeWork was there and the world was exciting in real estate. There was a lot of institutional money in the space. I came up with a thesis where you either had to do something different, and this is when WeWork was a good story, not a bad story, or you had to develop, because you had a lot of institutional capital buying not only the 50, 100, 500 unit buildings, they were buying single family rentals. And my thesis, which I believe deeply today, is you need to have edge. What separates you? And to me, that was development. So I thought I understood student housing. I was doing it at a very small scale. And then I started looking at how can I go take my expertise and add value to a company, but really learn. And I started at Aptitude Development close to 4 years ago now as an associate on the development team. And now I'm our VP of all new development. And we do ground up construction for student housing throughout the country. We've built close to 4,000 beds. We have about $250 million in construction going on as we speak right now. And we have about $500 million in our pipeline behind that. So very bullish on the space, you know, very proud of the buildings we build and the user experience we deliver for our residents, and also the returns we provide for our investors. So that's where I was, where I am, what I'm doing. And I'm happy to dig into kind of, you know, all of anything about student housing, because it's a very misunderstood asset class, in my opinion.
Oh, it sure is. It absolutely is. And I get to, and I told you off air that, you know, I get the pleasure of talking to you about this today, because it's something I know absolutely nothing about. I'm not ashamed to say it. I just have never dug into it. You can't know everything about every asset class. So I'm excited to ask you lots of questions on this front. How did you transition from, you know, raising money from friends and family, doing, you know, some smaller deals, and then just one day saying, all right, bag it, we're going to go into development? How did you make that jump?
Yeah. So to be fair, I mean, I am not one of the founders of Aptitude. I was doing my own thing on the side, really wildcatting. And when I came to the understanding that you have to develop buildings, you have to create value. That was when I said, who's doing it right now? Who's not the 1,000-pound gorilla, but doing it in the way that the 1,000-pound gorillas are, where I can go in and add value day one and not just be a cog in a wheel. And I kind of went through, you know, the different newspapers and conferences and who was talking and who was doing projects and who had a pipeline, emailed Aptitude, and they were like, we're not hiring. And I emailed them like, you sure? And they're like, yeah, we're not hiring. So I ended up somehow landing a meeting after pestering them for like 3 months. And then, you know, it took like 4 or 5 interviews. And I'm like, they essentially created a job for me. And they're like, all right, if it works out, it's a huge win for us. If it doesn't, you know, we'll keep doing what we're doing. And, you know, again, 4 years later, we're doing a lot of deals. And it's been a really great experience to work with people that you genuinely love going to the office with every day and who, you know, are creating value through what we do.
Let's talk about that. I mean, because there's a lot of people out there with a particular skill set, but don't necessarily know how to bring value to a larger organization such as what you did at Aptitude. So what was your pitch? I mean, hey, guys, I'll come work for free. Hey, guys, I mean, not that that's what you did.
But I value my time on a little bit too much, I think, in today's world. But I talk to people and, you know, they say, I want to go do this, but they're not hiring. Yeah, well, you know, listen, no offense. If you were that good, you probably wouldn't be looking for a job right now, right? Like, you still have a lot to learn and you need to add value in ways that other people aren't, especially for, you know, I went to a phenomenal college. I'm really proud of where I went, but I didn't go to an Ivy League and I didn't take the track of investment banking where I'm the most marketable person out there, right? I had to go out and teach myself the business. So, you know, my value proposition is I've done this. I know how to raise money. I know how to talk to banks. I know how to find contractors. I know how to manage a building at a small scale. I want to go do it for you guys at a really, really big scale. And, you know, it was a really kind of a bet for both of us on that this company is going to be around in 5 years and that I'm going to help get them to where they want to be in 5 years. But, you know, I talk to, you know, cousins or family members or, you know, younger people that are from my alma mater that ask for career advice. And I'm definitely not in a position to give that yet. But, you know, my advice is reverse engineer the process. Go pick the top 50 companies you love what they're doing and you want to work for. Call them. Ask if they're hiring. Ask, you know, go on their careers pages. What are they hiring for now? What is the, you know, the second effects of that? If they're hiring a bunch of engineers to build a platform, maybe they need people to go sell it in 6 months from now. So maybe you're a salesman in the door. So I think the problem is people look for jobs that are out there. And if you don't have a background, a track record that is what the filtering systems for resumes look like, you're not going to get your foot in the door. So you have to create that. You network, show up at the office with a resume, do what you got to do. I mean, if you want to do something, the only person stopping you is you.
Right, man. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Good times. All right. So you joined the company and then where'd you go from there?
Yeah. So since I joined, we've built 3 new projects. We built one in South Carolina at Coastal Carolina University, about 550 beds. We built one in Louisville, Kentucky. That's about 550 beds as well. I think it's closer to 564. We built 647 beds in Arkansas. And then we broke ground in Birmingham, Alabama, which is a 409 bed project at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. And, you know, I think part of what student housing, there's a misconception is that it's frat houses or single family homes with keggers, and they certainly have that in student housing. But, you know, unless you spend a little time in the business, it's extremely institutionalized now in a good way, where when I go to a contractor and they say, hey, I haven't built student housing, the only difference is we build bed to bath parity, which means if it's a 4-bedroom, it's a 4-bathroom. So if we have 409 beds, you have 409 bathrooms. So me, Sam, Jimmy, and Johnny are best friends and we want to go live in a 4-bedroom. It's fully furnished. You have washer and dryer. You have high-end countertops, a full living room with a 55-inch TV. And then you have your own walk-in closet and bathroom. And you have your bed, a desk, a dresser. You're showing up with essentially your suitcase, some linens, your laptop for school. Drop your stuff and you're good to go. And everyone signs per bed on the lease. So, you know, it's not like you have to find 4 friends and have all their parents guarantee it. I'm signing a lease for me. My parents would be guaranteeing it. Or if you, you know, have the financial background to do it yourself, you'd be guaranteeing your own lease if you qualify. And what that does is it creates a very stable rent roll because you have the guarantors. You're not taking a risk on someone that might not have no income or whatever that may be. And the other part of why that's interesting by renting by the bed is you have the largest effective rent per foot out of any asset class near your college campus. Now, granted, if you're going next to NYU or Columbia, I think you're probably going to get outbid for land from a developer or an office, you know, or a condo developer. but you know, when you're in the Arkansas of the world or even the Alabamas, I get a much higher effective rent per bed by leasing it by the bed because they're highly efficient spaces. But you're amenitizing the building and the value proposition for someone to rent by the bed and not be forced to go get a one bedroom on market if they, you know, want to live by themselves or just want to live in their own bedroom or whatever it may be. It's a really good deal. Typically, utilities are included. You know, we have nicer gyms than I've ever been to in New York City, which is where I live most of the time. You know, you have daily game nights. You have shuttles that take you to campus if you need that. You know, we have about 10-inch staff in the building. It's a really cool place to live with a great vibe. And I compare it to more of like an Avalon. We are the Avalon for student housing. We're creating a brand called The Marshall, which is typically what we call our buildings. It's just a fun place to live if you're, you know, a kid and going to school.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. Talk to us about, you know, like you're saying, renting by the bed. So how do you guys do floor plans? How do you split those out such that you know that you can optimize units rented?
Yeah, so you're typically seeing, you know, the square footage per bed at, you know, it's called on a four bedroom, 400 to 450 square feet per person. You know, and keep in mind, you're sharing four bedrooms, and then you have a living room that you all hang out in and a full service kitchen, and you'll have a washroom as well. But, you know, you have a lot of personal space, but we're not just doing four beds. So you'll have four beds, three beds, two beds, one bed studios. Some of them you have five bedrooms. We're designing what we call a five bedroom townhouse in the sky, where it's all penthouse level, five bedroom, two floors. That's going to overlook one of the college campuses next door. So, but by doing that is you're creating essentially more density in the building where you wouldn't really be allowed to do that by only doing studios, ones and a few twos.
What about to say you have a four bedroom and somebody wants that 1800 square foot unit, if it's 450 a person or per bed? Like, what if somebody says, hey, I want all four beds and I'll live there by myself. I want 1800 square feet. I mean, how does that work? They just pay for all four beds?
Yeah, they could pay for four beds. Or, you know, typically if you want like a 1500, 2000 square foot one bedroom, you probably go find a loft building that's more designed that way. But, you know, it's also typically not affordable for the average college student to go rent a four bed by themselves, right? So by us offering you to rent by the bed, and I don't say affordable, it's more of an attainable option, because if you only want to look at one bed, it's probably not that cheap. And or if you want to live with your friends, but you want your own private space, you have to do four one beds alone in a traditional building. Or, you know, and if you don't want to live in a frat house or a party house off campus, and we offer a great way for you to have your private space with everything included, and you still live with your best friends, and then you walk downstairs and you have study rooms and gyms and, you know, podcast studios and things like that that people are incorporating into the building for today's clientele. I mean, we have game rooms that are not game rooms with Buck Hunter, they're video game rooms because a lot of colleges are starting to have esports teams. So we're designing for the future consumer, which is really fun to think about from a design standpoint, but also understanding the clientele is a challenge in a fun way. But, you know, again, we're really focused on like health and wellness. So instead of a kid having to walk back from the library at 2 a.m. during finals week, they can go down the hall and have a full smart whiteboard and study rooms where they have, you know, privacy and quiet, and they can study for finals down the hall in the comfort of their own home.
Gotcha, man. That's amazing. I'd love to, if we get time here on this show, to break down kind of the return profiles and how you guys actually, let's just jump into that. What, like, when you guys build a project like this, what do you guys shoot for on a return profile basis? You say, okay, this is a viable project, and how do you get there?
Yeah. So, I mean, what we typically look for is our yield on cost, our development yield to what we feel we could exit at if we had to. We look for 150 basis point spread between what we can build to and what the market cap rate is. So that we feel that's a pretty good buffer. And then we look for a 15 to 20 IRR or a 2 to 4 equity multiple on all of our deals.
And the equity multiple being in over how many years?
So it depends, right? And that's a good question. So our deals are anywhere from a 3 to 10 year hold. We found that a lot of universities with the Opportunity Zone programs that came out a few years ago, the school is not an Opportunity Zone. But because the kids don't pay taxes in the area, but their parents are paying the rent, those are Opportunity Zone designations. So we've built actually what we believe is the first Opportunity Zone project in the country, which is in Louisville, Kentucky. And then our Arkansas and our Alabama projects are Opportunity Zone as well. And those are going to be 10-year holds due to the tax benefits.
Right. That makes a heck of a lot of sense, which brings up the next question. You're putting all these amenities in. You got TVs, you got bunk beds, you've got couches, you got this furniture.
Not bunk beds. They're full beds.
I'm still thinking 1980s dorm here in my head.
Imagine a modern apartment building where instead the only option you have is a one bedroom, a two bedroom, or a studio. you have the option to have a studio, a one bedroom, a two bedroom, a three bedroom, and a four bedroom, or potentially a five bedroom that you live in with friends. You can roommate match as well. And then instead of having a business center, you have study rooms. And instead of having a gym that's not the highest focus for most multifamily operators, 18 to 22 year olds get ripped. You know, they're in the gym a lot. And we build indoor outdoor gyms where you can literally say, hey, it's a great day out. Let me lift the garage door and, you know, my core workout on the outside. And then that's next to the pool where their friends are hanging out too. So it becomes a really fun environment and community within the building.
So that brings up the question, which is maintenance. Like maintenance and then, you know, the shelf life, the life cycle of the assets in there. Like how often is that stuff getting replaced? How do you budget in cost for that? I mean, if you're holding it for 10 years, that stuff's got to get, I mean, at some point couches and beds, I mean, especially in a college situation, I'm sure they don't last that long. How do you guys work around that?
Yeah, so we budget CapEx appropriately based on, you know, the projected hold period in the market. There's some markets that are bigger partier colleges and other ones. I mean, there's other colleges that are heavy engineering, nursing, pre-med, where you go in a study room and there's the anatomy of a body, and these kids are geniuses, right? And we know that that's not the party drive of the school, but we budget for CapEx anywhere from years 5 to 7, depending on the hold period. But that's also, part of the exit. What is the value add for the next guy? It could be updating the furniture, right? But we budget appropriately for that. And I think the other misconception about student housing, it's a single family home where kegs are being thrown off the roof. Again, this is an institutionalized class, asset class, from the sense of how you manage the building. You know, we have about 10 in staff. So there's, you know, anywhere from 2 to 3 quarters and maintenance guys. You usually have one super for the building. And then you'll have, you know, a GM, 2 AGMs, 3 to 4 leasing managers, and 4 to 6 community assistants that help with leasing. So there's cameras in every hallway. If you're going to knock down an exit sign because you're drunk one night, you're going to get fined for it. It's, you know, and I think there's a level of respect when they understand, hey, this is a nicer building. It's more adult-like. If they want to go live in, you know, an off-campus house, obviously college towns still have that. So that is an option for the renters. But we find it to be something our investors ask about all the time is, hey, is this place going to be torn down in the first year? And if it's staffed correctly and if you set the tone, well, we want you to have fun, but you know, be responsible. And that to this point hasn't been as big of an issue as a lot of people think it would be.
Right. Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Let's see. What have I not asked about? Oh, here's a great question. How did student housing fare through the pandemic? How did you guys pivot and what's it look like going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, student housing really made its name for being recession resilient. So in 08, when the world fell apart, most people that couldn't get a job went back to college. They went and got their MBA or their master's and whatever it may be. And enrollment shot up at schools. So while the rest of the real estate industry fell to shit, student housing performed like a gem. You know, and a lot of people loved the strength of the rent roll due to the parental guarantors. So what happened as time went along? Again, people continued to build. Schools enrollments continued to kick up. There's still a huge value in a college education, whether it be at a Harvard of the world or, you know, a large state school. And as COVID came along, this is the one thing that should have kicked the industry down a hill and never got back up from. The reality is, didn't want to live at home. You know, you had, you know, kind of the world shut down in, you know, that March, April area, but parents are still on the hook. You know, a lot of kids still stayed in the buildings for a period of time. And then most kids came back in the fall. So the one thing I think is interesting is during the pandemic, and everyone talked about, what are the opportunities? Where's the distressed assets? The number one industry for collections was warehouse, and they collected, I think, 98% as an industry. Student housing collected 96.5%. So college campuses were shut down in a lot of places. Kids weren't allowed to go to class in a lot of places. Parents were afraid to have their kids, which the headlines. We collect 96.5% of our rents, and our portfolio occupancy was very high, and the industry as a whole was very high. Because people underestimated that parents didn't want their kids at home, and kids don't want to be with parents. They said, fine, I'm going to go to class 3 days a week. I still want to be with my best friends. I'm 19 years old. I'm 20 years old. They did not want to live with their parents and ruin their college years. And we had very, very strong collections. And what happened was it really was recession resilient due to the strength of the leases and the atmosphere you have around the asset class, which is students. And what that did is you saw what, again, it should have took the knees out. Because everything that could have said, this is not the storm you want for student housing, where you have kids in confined dense areas and you have classes not open in a lot of places. And it showed it was very well. And once the world has started to normalize, you've seen some of the largest institutional investors in the world invest into student housing. Brookfield just signed a huge deal. Blackstone just signed a huge deal. you're seeing a ton of money flood into the space even more because they saw there's higher yields in the student housing space and traditional multifamily or even single family rental. And the asset class sticks up in the worst case scenarios.
I guess on the lease renewal side, even you guys didn't even have any problem on that come, you know, fall of 2020 or fall of 20 or I guess spring of 21.
Yeah. So, I mean, fall of 2020 at this point, right? We opened, we were leasing up during the pandemic and we opened 100% occupied. Mortgage came back that fall in South Carolina. And then we just opened up this fall in Arkansas, which, you know, again, was, they had a weird, funky year. There wasn't as many kids on campus to go market to. And we opened 100% Arkansas for a brand new build.
Wow. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. How do you feel? I mean, one of the comments that we hear a lot about is student debt and just the skyrocketing cost of education. How do you feel like you guys are positioning yourself such that if there is a shift in the winds, I guess, on the number of students going to college or, you know, maybe not as much money flowing into the space, how are you positioning yourself in that regard if you are?
Yeah, it's a fair question, right? And I think, again, that's somewhat of a misconception in terms of if it's just a headline where the average, let's call it parent or even child in the U.S. wants to go to college, right? If they can. And a lot of the smaller schools, like the community colleges or the liberal arts schools that are four-year degrees, but are not, you know, an Amherst of the world that are $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year are running into trouble. And you're seeing larger enrollment growth at your, you know, UGA's, Alabama's, Arkansas, you know, is exploding. ASU's projected to go to 90,000 kids. I mean, that's massive for a school's enrollment. So you're seeing the better value proposition schools do very well. And you're seeing the, you know, the 4-year liberal arts where no one's ever heard of it, does no value on a degree, get hurt. And those are being consolidated or going out of business. And those are schools we don't build at. You know, those are your 2,000, 4,000 person schools. That, you know, it's a great experience, I'm sure, for a lot of people, and they got a phenomenal education. But from an investment thesis, it's not something we focus on, and most banks won't lend on it either. So we typically focus on anywhere from 10,000 minimum person universities in enrollment, and then we look very heavily at location. So we talk about distance and density. Can I get a certain amount of beds to operate appropriately, and can I be close enough to walk to school? We call it a roll out of bed location. So if Sam and I go out on Thursday night, we have a good time. We have an 8 a.m. test for math. Can I walk to school? Can I roll out of bed and get to class? And if it fits those two things with the enrollment, and enrollment growth is one of the big things we look at, we'll take a real deep dive on a site or a market to look at. And I think when it comes to what's called multifamily or office, you're looking at, you know, job growth, wage growth, what is happening in this. And we look at all those things in a lot of detail, but we underwrite the school. What is the enrollment growth? Has there been any scandals, you know, the top brass at the school? How are the sports teams performing? When schools win national championships, they tend to attract more applications the next year. You know, what is the endowment of the school? And we underwrite the school really heavily. You know, where's rent growth? Where's occupancy? What is the supply demand fundamentals of the market? So do all of that research early on. And I think that's a big trend you're going to continue to see is why send your kid to a $70,000 a year, 2,000 person school that's not really going to help them in the real world versus a state school where you're getting a great education. And you're seeing that more and more.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Man, Zach, thanks for breaking that down. One last question for you. You know, we hear a lot about cost per door in multifamily. It sounds like maybe you guys would, you know, break this down, cost per bed. What is the average cost? And I know you guys are doing a lot of projects in a lot of areas, so this is probably an unfair question. But like, what do you typically see as a cost per bed cost to build?
Yeah, it varies, right? So, you know, you're, again, like, you know, let's call it like a Michigan or a Wisconsin, which has very high rents, but it's a pretty dense place to go build. You're not going to go find, you know, old farmland to be turned over or an old industrial site that is the next one to go. And you have to build vertically. Those costs are going to be much higher than your garden style product, you know, at a school that's exploding in growth. So, you know, we built at some schools recently that have grown like 30% in the last 5 years. So you can still find those pieces of dirt or tree or whatever it may be. And we've had a lot of luck with that. One of the other things we do when you talk about sourcing deals is we offer something called the 721A. So if you have, you know, maybe someone that owns the local pizza shop and the Chinese restaurant, and that's the retail with a ton of parking behind it, and they go, I have nowhere else to put my money. This is, you know, this is my best investment. I say, well, listen, instead of you selling your land or trying to 1031, why don't you 721A, which is the same thing as a 1031, but instead of them identifying a new asset to go buy in, they can actually exchange the price of the sale into our project as equity. So that, and I say, okay, well, we're going to go build a 10-story building. We can put ground floor retail like you had, and you can keep your restaurant there, but you can also take a part in the upside of the development. So that you're much more creative in that sense. And it's really just market dependent in terms of what you can pay for land.
Wow. Yeah. Very, very fascinating. Very fascinating. Zach, I've enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for breaking down the student housing industry, what you guys are doing, how you're positioning yourselves. Man, learned a ton today. Thanks again for doing that. Let's jump into the final few questions here. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I've spoken about this, you know, with some friends and family. I don't want to say blame this on the bigger pockets people, but I think everyone now thinks about real estate, right? Hey, I made a couple bucks in my day job. I want to go buy a building. Everyone made so much money in real estate. I want to get involved. There is no shame in going and being an investor with someone else. And I talk about this all the time. Don't take your life nest egg and go invest in a two family or a five unit or a single family. It is not mailbox money. Owning real estate is not easy, especially when you're buying small buildings to start out. You're going to have a bad management company. You're not going to get good contractors. And listen, this is not everyone, but it's very difficult to do. And I think people think they put down the down payment and then they're going to get mailbox money every month. So this is my advice to a lot of people that have asked me, how do I get started in real estate? And I say, go be an LP with someone you trust and you respect and you like what they're doing. Go invest in their deal and ask for a monthly call to learn more about what that update meant. And ask to go on a site visit twice a year and understand how construction's done a little bit and how things operate just a little bit. And start to get more exposure versus risking whatever you have with someone that doesn't know what they're doing or when you don't know what you're doing. And just because you listen to a podcast or a book, you could be incredible, right? You could be the best real estate guy out there, but maybe for your first project, understand how it's done a little bit more. You still get all the benefits of depreciation that's passed through, get all the benefits of appreciation. It's true mailbox money. And if you do it with someone that you respect and like, they're going to kind of teach you the business from their perspective, and you can learn and build on your education that way and make a significant return without betting the farm. And I think that's something that people don't talk about enough. You know, we take a lot of, we call it like friends and family money, but you know, a lot of them aren't friends anymore. They're friends of friends or cousins or you know, second friends from camp who from when they were kids. And, you know, they're high net worth individuals who invest in our projects, and they've invested in one or two and really like it. And now they're invested in six or seven of our deals. And there's no, you know, if you're interested in investing, call me, call Sam, understand the business, be an LP in someone else's deal. You can learn a lot and make a significant return. And then maybe when you're ready, you can go be a real partner adding value or go source your own deals. But I think that's undervalued and people don't think about it.
Man, that's great. That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Short story. I started a charity with some friends from high school, and we give out mentorship and funds towards, and you know, kids from our high school that came from some underserved communities, trying to even the starting line a little bit. And if you want to go into real estate, I'll connect you with Sam. And if you want to be a doctor, potentially, we'll connect you with a doctor when you're an undergrad, and you can figure out what path is best for you. And then if you want to go work at Google, but you need to go take extra coding classes, we'll help pay for that class. Or if you have an interview in New York, we'll help pay for a suit. I mean, we try and be, you know, a mentor network, but we've gone really deep and really thin for our hometown.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Cool, Zach. That's great. Last question. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
It's 2021. Text me, call me. You know, you don't need to call 1-800 number. You're welcome to email me, but my cell phone number is 781-789-4354. And you can email me gf@aptitudere.com. We can have Sam link it up in the show notes. But yeah, just call or text me. I'm always around. Happy to talk about the industry or you know, wherever I can be a resource. I'm always happy to help out.
Zach, thanks so much, man. Do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.